Hi, this is Dark Journalist. In my special report today, I have an exclusive interview with a man who once operated deep inside the national security state. His name is Robert Merritt, and his startling revelations will change the way we look at history forever. Now, Merritt is a credible source, as we'll see, who's been involved in covert operations since the 1970s. Today, he will reveal that President Richard Nixon was aware of and actively managed the alien presence and the UFO file. His amazing account of his time working for a clandestine program run directly out of the White House called the Houston Plan would have been startling enough. But there's more, including the incredible claim that President Nixon had a secret message with this powerful information placed in a time capsule to be opened long after he left office. Today, we're going to go deeper into the heart of the wall of secrecy that the government has placed around the alien presence and the UFO file. And we're going to do it through the figure of Robert Merritt. Now let's get started.
A year ago, on July the 24th, in the middle of the Pacific, an American aircraft carrier, I welcomed back from the moon three men who had been pioneers in landing on the moon.
The Dark Journalist exclusive interview. Nixon's ET time capsule. With former undercover Houston Plan operative, Robert Merritt. Now, let's go join Dark Journalist Daniel List.
Thank you, everyone, for joining me for this important broadcast. Now, before we bring out our special guest, former Houston Plan undercover operative Robert Merritt, let's take a brief look at the strange series of events that led to his historic meetings with President Nixon at the White House, where he learned history-changing secrets. Undercover operative Robert Merritt had come a long way from his upbringing in West Virginia. By the time he had his three meetings at the White House with President Nixon in 1972, he had been doing undercover work as a confidential informant for the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, the FBI, and the ATF. These assignments had him spying on different aspects of the radical groups that had caused so many problems for the Nixon administration. As a young man in his early 20s with an affable manner and friendly disposition, he could fit in almost anywhere. Later, he would be directed by these agencies to obtain lurid material that could be used to blackmail officials and congressmen. A snapshot of his covert work looks something like a mix of James Bond and government whistleblower Kathy O'Brien. In fact, his work was so pleasing to his superiors that he was profiled as the perfect candidate for something like an intelligence unit run right out of the White House called the Houston Plan. Essentially conceived as a kind of CIA just for the president, not much is actually known about this shadowy program. Some 31 pages of testimony regarding it from the Watergate era are still held under lock and key. Nixon felt he needed the advantage. Surrounded by domestic political enemies, he may have overestimated their chances for removing him in the 1972 election. Nonetheless, the Houston Plan and its star recruit, Robert Merritt, were busy performing covert operations and surveillance against Nixon's enemies. Merritt's third and final meeting with President Nixon came after the Watergate break-in. Nixon decided that Merritt was a man he could trust above anyone except his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger. He sent for Merritt in the usual fashion. After midnight, with no warning, a shadowy figure would come to Merritt's door and take him to meet with the president, in a room deep underneath the White House. Nixon needed Merritt to be a courier of some special documents to a high official. The information was above top secret and referred to the UFO file. Merritt sat shocked as the president read the letter aloud. Now, Nixon was an experienced hand on managing the UFO file from his days as vice president under President Eisenhower. The government had a public program at that time called Project Blue Book, but according to several whistleblowers, Vice President Nixon personally ran the so-called CIA Blue Book cases, the real crashes hidden from the public that involved crash retrievals of exotic UFO technology. Before they said goodbye in this final meeting, Nixon told Merritt he had a special letter, a kind of time capsule, that would be discovered at a future date. This message in a bottle was hidden in plain sight right in Washington, D.C. Now, Merritt has kept these three meetings and the hidden information about Nixon's time capsule secret for over four decades. Faced with a debilitating health ailment, he has decided to disclose here, on this show, today, what President Nixon told him beneath the White House. Information that will change history forever. Robert, it's great to have you here with us to share your important story and historic information.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure. Pleasure being here.
Now, you've had quite a career working in a covert role for these government agencies. You appeared at the Senate Watergate Committee and the New York Times. So the paper trail for your deep involvement in these clandestine operations is lengthy indeed. Now, I know you've tried to bring out information relating to some of these programs before and have been silenced. So we're fortunate to have you here today to go much deeper than you ever have.
Okay.
Now, we're going to focus today on the three meetings that you had with President Nixon in 1972. But before we do that, can you give us some idea, in your own words, of how you landed in Washington, D.C. at that time?
It all started in West Virginia when I was about 13, 14 years old, when I was raped by two Catholic priests. And I do not use the words seduced or abducted or assaulted. I was raped, okay? So, But, of course, that continued. And that led into a different life, which took me into Washington, D.C.
Right.
And when I got there, I worked as a postmortem technician for Children's Hospital, doing autopsies on children, removing hearts and aortas for the National Institutes of Health. They were doing heart research on children from birth to 21. And I did that for a few years, and then after that, I moved to a different area around DuPont Circle, Georgetown area. And from there, I did various types of jobs, and from working as a waiter and clerks and a series of jobs. I guess the most exciting event was, like I said, moving around DuPont Circle, and I met Boris.
Okay, now Boris was a Soviet attaché. Can you tell me more about him?
Boris was much older than me. I was in my very early 20s, and Boris was probably around, I don't know, in 60 or 70 or something. But we met. We lived next door to each other. I mean, the embassy was on the corner. It wasn't the embassy. It was a chancery to the embassy.
Right.
The actual embassy was on 16th Street. But the chancery there was at 18th Street and Riggs Place Northwest, and I lived next door to it. And I lived on the western side of the hallway on the second floor. I mentioned that because on the eastern side of the hallway, every apartment was rented by the CIA, FBI, because those apartments faced the chancery, and they were doing their wiretapping, eavesdropping, and from those apartments on this side. But anyways,
now, how would you describe your relationship with Boris?
Boris and I were just friends. We were just simply friends who enjoyed each other's company. And we would meet every morning and go to a diner, pharmacy on the corner of Connecticut and Archery North, have coffee, have breakfast, and just small talk.
Okay.
Then about, I don't know, a year perhaps went by, and then I was stopped one day and approached by the FBI, CIA on a couple of different occasions, not together, of course, but they were both interested, and they had slew of pictures of Boris and I together at the pharmacy and on the streets, and I found it not only amusing but very offensive and very insulting. And I felt like, you know, what's the implication? I'm a spy or something for the Soviets because I know Boris, but Boris and I never talked about anything that much. I can only remember very, very little of anything he ever talked about that would be of any interest to Russia or the USSR.
Right.
But I didn't have any secrets concerning the government anyways, anything that I'm sure that the Soviets would want to know. I was not in the position at that time. We were just friends.
So in essence, they were tracking Boris, and you got caught up in their surveillance because you just happened to be there.
Yes, that's basically, Daniel, where it all started, except that it was unbeknownst to me that a lot of little small things, which we don't have time to go into, that happened, actually, from my arrival, I don't know, maybe it even started in West Virginia, perhaps. I always feel sometimes that my whole outlife was destined for that type of work.
Now, that's a perfect way to lead in to how all this came about. Now, we know if we look ahead that all these events will lead to your meetings with President Nixon in an underground location at the White House as part of the Houston Plan. But before all that, you met someone named Carl Schauffler, who history buffs will know as the arresting officer of the covert operators that broke into the DNC at Watergate. Now, obviously, the FBI and the CIA had you on their radar after questioning you, and Schauffler, we'll learn, had some very deep connections to intelligence agencies. But before all that, before Watergate, Schauffler recruited you for undercover work.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, actually, when I first started working for the government in any undercover capacity is when Schauffler approached me. He'd been hanging out at DuPont Circle, where I wasn't many people, and it was a very diversified politically and culturous type of community there.
Mm-hmm.
I was involved in working for the police intelligence through Carl Schauffler. I was involved in a lot of different things. I mean, small assignments. I targeted over like 200 different political organizations, over a couple thousand private people. When I say a couple thousand, I'm talking about stealing anti-war petitions, stealing their mail, breaking into places. This was on embassies. This was on the Institute for Policy Studies.
Now, you mentioned the Institute for Policy Studies there. Do you want to name some other institutions that were targeted?
There were so many, many offices around DuPont Circle that was involved in the anti-war movement, and also it was anti-Nixon, anti-government.
Amazing. Wow. You were building up quite a track record there. Now, how many years of this kind of activity are we talking about?
Well, it brought me up to 1970. That started, Daniel, like in 1968. And like I said, there was multiple organizations, people from every culture, every race, every class, every political factor, with Republicans and Democrats, whether it was the communists, the Nazis, whatever. I managed to seem to touch base with them all.
Mm-hmm.
I was in my early 20s. At that time, I was a young, cute, blonde-haired, green-eyed kid, and had a lot of sex appeal, and that meant big trouble for me to have those type of looks, because then the FBI and they started asking me to target people, and I targeted over 70-some congressmen, senators, and ambassadors, and some people from the private sector to have homosexual sex with.
Right, and what you're saying is that they had you engage in these sexual encounters that they could document and record and then use against the people involved. Now, how was the surveillance carried out?
The FBI rented a room at the DuPont Plaza East Hotel, which was right on DuPont Circle, and the room was rented and maintained just for me all year round. And it was, of course, set up with very secret cameras and audio equipment everywhere. So when the door opened up, the machines came on. They were never discovered. And like I said, I'd taken over 70-some different subjects in there who I had filmed.
Amazing. And how would you describe your role in these operations?
I was just a mechanical prostitute robot. That's all it was. I just did whatever they wanted to at their request, and just in order to do the assignment and to get rid of the target. I had no personal feelings.
So would you say that these government agencies very much controlled your activities at that point?
They thought they did, and they wanted to. But if you read my FBI Freedom of Information Act papers, you'll see page after page after page that Robert Merritt was uncontrollable. He did, given an assignment, I would do excellent work. But I was described by my handlers that I would do excellent professional work, much more beyond their expectations of me than what they had ordered. But I would never follow their instructions. I always did things my way.
So you were taking some chances there, breaking the rules, but somehow you got away with it.
They were so pleased, and their supervisors were so happy with it, they were told just to leave me alone, let me operate independently.
Got it. They liked the results you were getting for them, the targeting of individuals, the sex blackmail tapes to be used as control files. You were excelling at the covert op missions that they were giving you. Now, after developing this track record, you were recruited into the Houston plan. The details about this plan are still shrouded in mystery, even all these years later, and the records of it are covered up even now. What we do know is this. It was a program that was submitted by Nixon aide Tom Houston for illegal activities, surveillance, break-ins, a kind of elite squad to be developed for intelligence gathering of the darkest kind. Now, how were you recruited into the Houston plan?
The Houston plan came about when I started working for MPD, Metropolitan Police Department Intelligence, with Dixie Gildon, G-I-L-D-O-N. At that time, she was a sergeant and moved up to lieutenant, which was the last position in the regiment.
Now, as I understand it, Dixie was not an ordinary civil servant.
Dixie was a very affluent woman who did not work for the police department for the money. Her husband was very, very wealthy, and they had a big mansion on the outskirts of D.C.
Now, she's a fascinating character in her own right, but just for the sake of time, what really was her relationship to you?
She was my handler during the time. She worked for, like you said, the police intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
I was passed from Crossoffer over to her, but Crossoffer always remained in the picture. For one thing, he was my roommate. But anyways, getting back to Dixie, they gave me the Dixie. Dixie worked intelligence. And so did Carl, by the way. Carl worked for the police department. That's what he wanted people to think. That was the end of it. That's where he worked and nowhere else. But Carl was working for the FBI. He worked for the CIA. He worked for military intelligence. He worked for the Pentagon. He worked for Army intelligence.
Wow.
And the bottom line of those things, he was basically military intelligence.
Now, as I understand it, Schaffler came from the military.
He was in the military. He did work intelligence, but it always maintained after he left the military and went to the police. The police, Carl, was just like a cover job.
Right.
So people wouldn't guess about the intelligence.
So they turn you over to Dixie. Now, what did you talk about?
She was afraid that I was going to quit on her without her, unless she revealed to me what she really wanted and expected from me. And then that's when she told me about the Houston plan, and that I was really getting paid, and my orders was going to come from them.
Uh-huh.
And the Houston plan was originally by a man named Tom Houston in connection to the president's request, and it was being done out of the White House. I was told that their motive was to phase out and get rid of, believe it or not, the CIA and the FBI intelligence.
This move by Nixon to create the Houston plan was an incredible gamble.
President Nixon wanted the intelligence under his control, directly under his control.
Uh-huh.
And that was the purpose of the Houston plan.
So President Nixon was setting up his own intelligence unit run right out of the White House, not to supplement the intelligence agencies, but he wanted to bypass them completely on his own terms. So they looked at the work that you had done, and they recruited you into the Houston plan.
Yes, I was their only recruitment, by the way.
Looking back now, does this invitation to be in the most covert of intelligence programs seem like it was arrived at by testing you with all of these various intelligence assignments?
I understand that it was because of the Houston plan. It was because of the White House where they were trying to direct me to go into, and they were the ones who were profiling me. They were the ones who were sort of grooming me, I guess you could say, to work for the Houston plan.
Right. So you were made into an undercover Houston plan operative. Then what happened?
I was given a code name, Top Cat, and my code number was 003.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a reference to them about this. Well, does that mean that I'm before 007? I was referring to the movie before James Bond. They laughed, said, yes, and we guess you had something over on him, so you were sort of the first.
Well, there you were, the ultimate agent of the Houston plan, one of the most elusive covert programs in history. Now, your work with the Houston plan led you to these powerful meetings with President Nixon. Can you tell us about that here?
There was only three. There was only three, Daniel. There was one, and that was like an introductory type of thing. Just I'll tell you one, and then that's how the others occurred.
Okay.
I was picked up like 3 o'clock, I think, was the latest they ever picked me up. But there's always, they were always after midnight hours. When I hear the politicians talk about, I'm going to get the president's talk about that 3 o'clock phone call. I sort of amused myself thinking that, you know, the 3 o'clock visit I got to meet the President of the United States. And here I consider myself just to be a an illiterate, uneducated, uncultured hillbilly from West Virginia. I come to Washington, D.C. Here I'm sitting in the White House with the President of the United States.
It's a remarkable journey, and I can only imagine your state of mind at the time. Now, the process of getting you to the White House also sounds unnerving enough. Can you tell us about that here?
I had no warning. I think it was about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, but I have no idea. He never introduced himself, never showed me an invitation, badge, nothing, but he just said that he was there to take me to the White House and that there was someone very big who wanted to see me. He did not say the President. I trusted him as to his appearance without any identification. I mean, looking back on it, I mean, it could have been a kidnapper or a hitman to take me to my grave, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyways, he did drive me to the White House, and I went through to the Executive Office Building. At that time in the morning, the hallways were dimly lit. There was a security guard on duty. And we went in through a side door, like, on the front, down that long corridor to the rear of the building, down a small staircase to an elevator that was only big enough for maybe like 3 people to stand in. And I couldn't tell if it was moving. There was no dial inside the elevator to say, you know, what floor you was on, nothing. And it didn't feel like it was even moving at all. I mean, it could have been moving sideways. I could not tell. But anyway, when it did open up, we came out into several hallways that zigzagged around, and finally we came to a door that he opened up. It was the quality of the door, the wood grain, I think it certainly was nothing that would go into a regular office building like the old executive buildings building that I just went into. So
right.
I had a feeling that was the door leading into the White House, and it was. I opened it up, and there was a red carpeting there. The walls were not a scratch on them, not a flaw in the paint, nowhere. Rather fancy type of lighting, and it was a very, very long hallway. And we got to the end of the hallway. The person, agent, whatever he was, opened up the door, and the President was sitting behind the desk. He immediately got up, came over, shook my hand, and he told my escort, he said, go to the end of the hallway and stand there. He said, I don't want anybody by the door.
Now, what did the President say to you?
He noticed that I was visibly shaken by this whole thing, and he assured me that I was perfectly safe, and it was only to see him, to discuss certain things with him, that I was there to assist him and to help the country in what he called a national security matter. And he mentioned several things about the anti-war demonstrators and people who was on the far left that he considered to be a danger or upsetting to his administration and to the affairs of our country, which, of course, was just the Vietnam War that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I just talked about just very casual things. He was filling me out. He knew everything about me, everything that Simon and I had almost been on. And he told me I had done splendid work. He had reviewed those reports and that I was the type of person he was looking for. I reminded him that I was just an illiterate hillbilly, barefooted hillbilly from West Virginia. And he laughed and he said, listen, he said, you're none of those things. And he said, you're a very bright, intelligent young man. I admire you and respect you. He said, because you carried out all those assignments. He said, I understand you did so not at the exact instructions of our agents who were your handlers. He said they had a little problem with you because you were not carrying out their orders as directed, but you carried it your way. But they said that in the reports that even though you did it in your way and not their way, that you're productivity was far much more than what they exceeded and what they had expected, and they were very happy, very pleased
mm-hmm.
with what you produced. And he made comments about my school. He said, you come from an area, he said, West Virginians are known to be very honest people, he said, and very people who don't bite their tongues, and he said, you're very loyal people in school. He said, you probably said the Pledge of Allegiance every morning and salute the flag, and he said, and You probably even said the Lord's Prayer too, didn't you? I said, yes, I said, I did all those things. He said, well, unfortunately, we don't have that anymore, almost. He said, that's what I like about, especially West Virginia. He said, they're all red, white, and blue people. And I said, well, I didn't know that their country was any other way.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, I think you're about to get a history lesson to find out that it's not as red, white, and blue as you think it is. And he said, I know that sounds bad coming from the President of the United States, but I, too, he said, had to learn that lesson the hard way.
Now, what else happened in that first meeting?
Basically, Daniel, that was the first meeting. I mean, he talked about profiling me and...
That's fascinating. It sounds like he wanted to create a relationship with his main Houston Plan operative, and you became a trusted source for the president at that point.
Yes, I did.
Now, it sounds like Nixon expressed his approval in how you carried out your covert assignments.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
So then that first meeting ended. What did he tell you as you left?
We would talk again, and he said, based on the fact as to who you are and the secrecy of these meetings, which he swore me to secrecy and to loyalty to him and to the country, that I would never divulge these meetings to anyone at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt comfortable in divulging these meetings ever until just now. This is the first time they've ever been divulged. And I've done 558 shows, newspapers, magazines, the web, TV, radio, the whole nine yards. I've never talked about these meetings before. Never. Never talked about my meeting one-on-one with the President of the United States. Never.
Well, we're all very grateful for that, and I know the powerful place that your testimony is coming from.
This is the last expose of my life.
Coming up, Robert Merritt shares important details of his historic meetings with President Nixon in 1972.
Let's go into the second meeting that you had with President Nixon, which took place just before the Watergate break-in. Now again, an agent showed up unannounced after midnight to take you to the White House.
Yes, it was about 5 days before the Watergate, June the 17th, and those agents appeared exactly the same way, not the same agent, however. Again, these agents did not talk to me, no conversation, not even about the weather. I would ask them a casual question and be friendly with them, no response at all, nothing. And they just said, we're to take you to your destination. I'm sorry, but we cannot have any conversation. That was their reply.
Now, how did you arrive to meet the president this time?
Same exact way, same building, same entrance, same elevator, and through the down the small set of staircase to a maze of different hallways and corridors, and until we reached the same door that led into the White House. The same way that Nixon was there and was waiting. Again, they were told, you know, to wait at the other end of the corridor. Nixon had praised me on how I carried out some of my undercover assignments and Houston plan assignments, which had been given to me.
Now, what were the assignments that he was praising you for, and where did they take place?
The Institute for Policy Studies and some embassies on Embassy Row and a lot of different places around DuPont Circle area, which was multiple. I mean, there must have been dozens of, not over 100 and some. They were all anti-war, anti-Nixon, anti-government type of organizations. They were very radical.
Nixon again wanted to give you props for your skill in doing the covert work. He was comparing you now with some of the top FBI guys. So you were achieving his goals of surveillance, disruption, intelligence gathering. Now, most of these assignments were not pretty, even for deep political operations. But you had no problem with any of it. In fact, he was now calling you a super plumber, which was a reference to his trusted loyal circle of ex-intel agents that eventually got caught doing the Watergate burglary. But at the time, it must have been a really high compliment.
Yes, he used that word, and then he did praise me for the work. They did give me pet names, and they kept making references to James Bond and...
Interesting. So now he told you he had some new assignments for you. Can you tell me about those?
Well, One was to set fire or to bomb the... When I say bomb, I'm not talking about dynamite or explosives. It was to actually to set a small fire within the institute that was spread and would have caused... Well, could have caused the building to burn down. The other one was to kill a professor at American University, which he never gave me the name of, but they were going to. But both of those assignments were called off because the break-in happened.
Yes, the break-in changed everything, and it would happen shortly after the second meeting with President Nixon. What I find fascinating is that at this meeting, you tried to give him information that you discovered about the break-in before it happened. Now, the information you got was from someone that they call a drag queen in those days, named Rita Reed, and Rita was a switchboard operator at Columbia Plaza Apartments and overheard individuals discussing the break-in.
Yes.
Now, how did Nixon react to this information about Rita Reed?
Well, when I told him about the Rita Reed thing, you know, he wasn't extremely happy because it was a drag queen who gave me that information. He would always refer to Rita Reed as James Reed, and he, not she. I had a habit of calling James by Rita Reed, and as a she, because if you had ever met this person, you would have, I don't think you would have had any choice. I mean, there was just absolutely no signs of Rita having any masculine or physical signs at all. I mean,
right.
There's nothing there. You thought you were talking to an ordinary female.
So because of the source of the information that you had, he was discarding the warning. But he also mentioned that he knew about another plan to break into the DNC.
The plan that he knew about was to get these catalogs or books on prostitution, male and female, both. And I heard there was some pedophile stuff there, too. And he wanted to use it, even though he didn't come out and tell me this directly, but he might as well have the way, and I can't remember his exact words he used, but, you know, he said, this might be good stuff. He says, for the new election. And he referred to them as a bunch of perverts and pedophiles.
So it sounds to me like he thought he was going to sit back and watch this damaging stuff come out about the Democrats, not realizing the break-in would be used to destroy his presidency.
Yes, that's correct.
And you emphasized to him, well, this might be more serious than you think.
Yes, I did, John. But unfortunately, during that particular meeting, I was not aware until a few days later of more circumstances regarding that break-in, and I found out that there was more than one agency involved. There was maybe three, four, possibly even five different agencies all involved in this break-in. And none of them knew what the other one was doing. That was the ironic thing about it. They actually did not know, and they were working independently from each other. Or if they did know what each other were doing, then they were doing it in such a clandestine, competitive way that they weren't going to reveal their position.
That's fascinating. Can you mention some of the agencies that were involved here?
It was the FBI, it was the CIA, it was National Security Agency, it was the military, it was also Interpol. I mean, it was just different agencies and groups involved in the whole thing.
Amazing. So you brought this up, and ultimately Nixon just thought he had it under control, and he ended the discussion around it.
Yes.
Now, how did this second meeting with President Nixon at the White House end?
Nothing spectacular other than the fact that he was concerned about all the publicity that this was going to generate.
Mm-hmm.
He said that if this goes wrong, he said it could go wrong, he said, in the worst sort of way. I remember him saying those words exactly. And as you know, it did. So...
Absolutely, and it was only a few days away. Now, was there any indication at the end of this meeting that you two would be meeting again?
Yes, he did. He said, we'll meet again, and he said that will probably be the last time. Hopefully not, he says, but it probably will be. But I'm going to try my best, he says, to meet with you again. And he did.
Coming up, Robert Merritt discusses his third and final meeting with President Nixon at the White House following Watergate. A distraught Nixon revealed to Merritt the ET presence and a secret time capsule that would someday change history.
And Robert, when did the third and final meeting take place?
The last meeting was in in the middle part of July.
Mm-hmm.
And same the same way as far as getting me into the building, same type of pickup, and same circumstances that he was behind the desk, only this time he did not come to the door. He told the agent to leave, go in the hallway and shut the door, and told me to have a seat, and he didn't even stand up to even shake my hand. He just nodded, and he was holding his head down, and he was visibly crying.
Hmm.
And there was tears actually coming down his face. And I got very quiet. I didn't know what to say and console him. My first inclination was to stand and walk around my desk and give him a hug with my arm on his shoulder or something.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's the president of the United States. You know, you just don't do that. He's not the ordinary man sitting in that chair. He was the president of the entire world, in my opinion.
Right.
But on his desk, he had the copy of the New York Post on there, and it was, I can't remember the headlines, but it was very, very visibly a headline against the president and leading into something that obviously meant to his demise, and it was true, and I think that's obviously, I think it's why he was upset and dropped a couple of tears, but he was trying so bad to hold that back.
So he knew right then that this was going to be used to drive him from office, and he was visibly upset. So he used some sentimental language at that point?
At that time he did, yes. He said the only friends he had, and he said, I'm not kidding you. He said, it's Henry Kissinger. He said, and then he paused, and he said, you know what? You. And I said, Mr. President, he said, yes. And he said, called me by my nickname, Butch. He said, yes, Butch. He said, you. He said, you know what? He said, you've been here meeting me. He said, only a couple of times. He said, the years I've become president and involved in politics, he said, you have shown me very earnest and honest, he used the word love. And he said, the compassion that you show me, he said, is one of a great friendship. And he said, I wished that our relationship had been, you know, much longer and much earlier in the game. And he said, I think with you and the abilities that you have to resolve things and to dissolve things, he said, I wonder if any of this stuff could have ever happen. And I felt he was giving me a lot of credit for things that I thought was impossibilities, but.
Wow, an emotional scene there. Can you take us back into this moment again of when you came into the office and you saw Nixon?
Yes, he was teary-eyed, and he actually asked me to see one or two drops come down his face. I didn't know what to do. I mean, you know, he maintained his position on the side of the desk. I'm in a big chair on the other side of him. I didn't feel comfortable, and getting up was what I wanted to do, was to get up and walk around, you know, tomorrow and hug him or something to console him. But, God, there might be a camera in here, something that's going to blow my head off if I make a sudden move. I mean, after all, I was still nervous about being next to this the greatest man on the face of the earth as far as I was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And, but anyways, he cleared up and he started talking to me. He said, listen, he said, I appreciate everything that you've done. He said, I knew there was things I asked you to do, because he did ask me to have someone assassinated, which we never got a chance to do, but I would have done it for him gladly. I had no problem. I'd already done these things before, and I never had any problem doing it, carrying out the orders. I never had any guilty conscience about anything I did like that anyways, and it wasn't just one. It was multiple.
Well, these covert agencies from the start had programmed you to do that work, and as I understand it, they used the national security reasons. But in any case, I think it gives us some idea of your frame of mind at that time. Now, back to this crucial third meeting. Nixon was actually thanking you.
Yes. Well, he was thanking me, and then he started getting a little serious. He had this letter-sized briefcase, something we hold maybe about 12 sheets of paper, so it was something that somebody would carry. I mean, like a lawyer or something, for to be maybe like on one specific event, something they didn't want to be mixed in with the regular briefcase of all these other things.
Right.
And anyways, he pulled it out and he read this one piece of paper to me and basically, again, thanked me for what I did and talked about, you know, people he could trust, which he limited down to Henry and myself, of course, Henry being Kissinger. But he did not say Kissinger in front of me.
Mm-hmm. It was always Henry.
Until the very end. And then he put that letter in an manila envelope, and he pushed the little metal things back and put a piece of tape, not a piece of tape, but a seal, like a little small gold seal looking, over top of the metal, whatever they called. Then he put a piece of tape across that, and then on the front was handwritten to Henry Kissinger. And he actually had even put the stamps on it. I think maybe 7-8 stamps. I don't remember what they were, but it was enough postage to cover it.
Uh-huh.
But he asked for it to be hand-delivered or to mail it, whichever was best and safest to do.
Now, this letter was very important. Can you describe the letter for me?
It talked about there was two red lines, and it was a coded thing. And I don't know how to describe the codes to you except to say that they look like a scientific formula with letters, numbers, and other scientific symbols that would be used, like chemistry symbols,
mm-hmm.
if you know what I'm talking about, because I don't even know if I could even draw them for you at this point in time, but they were very foreign to me.
Okay.
But they were something that I'm sure any college professor would understand in science and biology and chemistry. I'm sure they would understand perfectly what they were. But anyway, it was that. Plus, he was talking about, which he read to me. He said, "We have possessed knowledge." He said, "And we have in our protection." He didn't say captivity. I thought he did not. I kept thinking, he said, no. He said, "In our protection." He said, "Subjects from the planet X." And I asked him one question, and he didn't seem to like what I asked him, but I thought, well, I'll just keep my mouth shut. I said, "Are these the things that which you're hearing about, you know, in Mexico or Area 51? But whatever I said, he seemed to be offended by the fact that maybe I knew this or that the public had general knowledge of this.
Okay, now this is fascinating. In this final meeting with Nixon, he's reading you this letter. He shows you this formula, and he's now mentioning an alien they have in protection. And he's a little annoyed that you mentioned the being was in custody or being held.
Yes, but not the word he used was protected. Protected. Not captured, not in captivity. He didn't use any words that would mean they're against the will of it.
Okay.
But, I mean, obviously, I mean, you know as well as I do, if we had a being like that, yes, it would be in captivity. I mean,
yes.
I don't think we'd let it walk down the street, but... But he said that the knowledge that we had obtained from him, he said, was so vast, and he said, and so powerful. He said, whoever would possess it, he said, would be the most powerful person in the entire world.
Now, from what I understand, you said he mentioned that scientists at Los Alamos had learned to communicate with this being. In your own words now, what did he say about that?
That we had obtained a very vast amount of knowledge from it, and very powerful, that whoever possessed this knowledge and was able to learn from it would be the most powerful person, most powerful nation or government in the entire world and could rule the world.
Rule the world. Now, just to clarify, going back to this ET being for a moment, the formula that was in the letter in red ink, that was the result of the scientists communicating with the ET. It was, in fact, the ET's formula.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yes, it is, yes. Yes, because he made it very clear. He said, only those who have knowledge, he says, will understand red ink, what's written in red ink. And the two lines were written in red ink from a pen, not a typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only thing that was colored. The other ink was black, and he used a red ink pen to write two lines, and they were symbols, not numbers, not alphabet, but they were some type of symbols.
So it clearly looked like a scientific formula.
Yeah, it looks just like a formula that you would see some brilliant genius scientist who writes on the blackboard, you know, all this stuff. It takes forever and ever to get a simple answer from, and it was that type of I don't know if you call it lettering, numbers, I don't know what it would be, but there's nothing that I was familiar with. But it was very carefully done, though, I'll tell you.
Mm-hmm.
He painstakingly wrote those two lines, like he duplicated them from something.
Incredible. Now, what did he tell you that they meant?
He didn't. He said only those, he says, who would know. He said would be able to do that. And then there was a handwritten letter. It was actually two pages to that one letter, and there was a handwritten letter, he says, also to Henry Kissinger, which he did not read to me, that he said was a personal letter.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the first letter with the to the American people.
Okay, so let's take a look at what the president had here. Can you describe for me what he had?
It was in one envelope, the letter to Kissinger was in another envelope, and then there was two cassette tapes in a small padded envelope. And he put everything inside of one large envelope and sealed it up in front of me. And he wrote something over the flap, and it was not his signature. There was nothing on there that indicated that this was coming from the president, or this was the president saying it. And it certainly didn't have the White House or Nixon's name and return address.
Now, you've told me that at some point during this meeting, Nixon actually taped this envelope to your stomach.
Yes, he did. He used some sort of white cloth type of medical tape that doctors use when they finish up maybe a surgery on somebody and they have them quite bandaged up, and they use this white tape. I don't know what they would call it, but that's what it was. It was like a cloth-type tape.
And he felt that the contents were a powerful message for mankind.
Yes, he did. He did.
Now, did he ever describe the E.T. physically?
No.
Call it an E.T.?
He didn't refer to it that way. He did not refer to it as a creature, a monster. He didn't use any of those words. He referred to it only as a very sophisticated, very intelligent being. That's the word he used, yes. But he did not describe it as having arms, legs, or eyes, or nothing else. He did not.
Did you feel compelled at all as he was reading the letter to ask him?
No, and he told me not to ask any questions.
Ah, okay.
He told me that he was right. That's the only part, of our conversations. He told me, he said, before I read this to you, he said, you must not ask me any questions. He said, I will not convince you. He said, it'll be rather offensive to me. He said, if you disobey my request.
In all honesty, as best as you can remember now, and we've seen you have a remarkable memory, what did you think while he was telling you all this?
I guess I'm the doubting Thomas because I was sort of skeptic about what he was talking about. But I was skeptic only because I have no knowledge of that sort of thing. I've never had any interest in it either.
Uh-huh.
And even though my subject in school, I mean, it was straight A's in science and biology and chemistry, but when it comes down to believing, you know, in outer space life, I don't know. I guess without scientific proof that was presented to us, it was like so many others, I didn't know.
Robert, you were definitely a trusted operative of the Houston Plan, but why do you think he told you this?
Because he said that he didn't trust anybody in the world, he said, except for Kissinger and myself. And I said, why me? I said, Mr. President, I said, you're the most populous person on the face of this earth. I said, you control our all the military. I mean, the airports, the Navy, the Marines. I mean, everything is at your disposal. The Pentagon, all the chief and commander. I said, of everything. And he said, yes. He said, but you know what? He says, none of them are called Robert Merritt.
Mm.
And he said, no, they don't have degrees. He says, being the ridge running hillbilly from West Virginia, either, as you do. And he was simply just telling me that, I guess, in his eyes, I was just a simple country boy who was was just being honest.
Do you feel like he wanted you to reveal what he told you about the alien at some point?
Yes, I do. But he didn't tell me when the time was right. I said, well, can you be more specific? He said, you'll be in touch with. And I said, Mr. President, I said, you know, I could die tomorrow. And he said, well, he said, but Henry's still living. And I assume that the only two people on the face of this earth that have that knowledge, other than those who actually work with these things out there in Mexico or Nevada, wherever they're kept, but it would be Kissinger and myself. And why me? I don't know. I just cannot answer it. And so it still remains a huge puzzle to me to this day. And it upsets me very badly because of my ill health right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where to go with this. I think that's why I'm hurriedly trying to get this information with you, Daniel, because I don't know where to go with this.
Robert, you're doing a great job of recounting all this. I know the message in the letters is important, and the knowledge we obtained working to communicate with the alien being. What I want to do is go into this in some greater detail now. Let's start with where these meetings take place again. They took you to the White House, obviously. But where in the White House do you think that it was? Can you describe exactly where you think it was?
That would be a job. I was driven to the Executive Office Building right in front and went through the front door. There was a guard there on the other side. The place was dark because, I mean, it was like about 3 o'clock in the morning. And there was very dim lights throughout the building. And anyways, we were getting I was with only one person, assuming that that one person who he never would talk to me during the ride there, ride back, he would not say shit to me, excuse my language, as to what the weather was like. He just would not talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
I assumed that he was a Secret Service agent, but he could have been somebody else, anybody else, really. But anyways, we went in, we went to the rear of the hallway to the back of the building, and then down a short set of steps into a very small, like a 2 or 3 person elevator, a very small thing. And when the doors are shut, there was no face inside the elevator as to tell you what floor you were on, whether you went up or down or what floor.
Hmm.
And it felt like it was not moving at all. I mean, it was just eerily quiet and no movement. And when it did open up, we went down a hallway and we turned left. We went down a small set of steps, maybe about 7 or 8 steps down to just a lower landing, and then from that hallway, a very, very long hallway.
Mm.
I would have to say that if there's a sub basement to the White House, that's where I was at.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like it's deep underground.
Yeah, the last hallway I came into, it did have a red carpet on the floor. The walls were kept perfectly. Not a mark on them, nowhere. Not a scratch, not a piece of plaster or paint, chipped, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one man who was standing outside the door who, when he saw me and the other agent coming, then he opened the door, and then the president, you could see him straight on. He opened up the door, the president came behind the desk, came to the door, greeted me, and then he told that person, he said, do not stand here anymore. He said, go to the far end of the hallway and wait there.
Okay. So you were alone. You were alone with him.
Yes. 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 Absolutely. Yes.
How would you describe the office where you met the president?
And the office was very presidential. I mean, it was not the Oval Office. I mean, I was way below ground, not above ground. But it was not oval shaped at all. It was just a square room. There were bookcases all around the walls and some paintings.
Wow, it sounds like an incredible environment. Now, Robert, I understand from our conversations that my next question touches on some very important and totally unknown information. But you've said that as President Nixon was reading you the letter, there's a point where he stops and tells you that he has a copy of this letter hidden somewhere in the White House, and no one will find it until the time is right.
That's correct.
A kind of time capsule with this powerful information inside. Now, can you tell me about that?
You know, he did put something away in the White House. I'm not going to say where it is, but it's there.
Okay, well, let me ask you just a little more about this, and I appreciate you opening up as best you can.
sure.
Now, I understand that you're not ready to reveal the location publicly of the time capsule message, but my question is, do you think that the message is still there?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Nixon was just clever enough to know where to stash it, where it could remain, undisturbed.
Yes. And he also said that in time, he emphasized that word three times like he always did. Three was his favorite thing. He said that it would be discovered.
Well, what is so intriguing for me is that we have the mystery of Nixon reading you this letter about the ET presence. And then he goes further and tells you about saving it as a time capsule of sorts. It's almost as if, in getting all of these reports about your talent for memorizing things like license plates and addresses in all these assignments that he sent you on, that he felt in you he had a human recorder, a kind of personal time capsule for all this.
Well, maybe you're the key to that time capsule. Maybe you're unlocking it.
Yes.
I hope. If this broadcast or whatever you do to release this through your media means is to shed light on the president and to so that he was innocent, he was not guilty of these things, then so be it.
Mm-hmm.
It concerns me, but the fact even today that even though all this stuff happened is 100% true, how much will anybody believe Robert Merritt? I mean, again, I would have to say I was just a hillbilly from the state of West Virginia, a Ridge Runner. I mean, you know, this is what people want to say. You know, I was not on the White House staff. I wasn't connected. I had no diplomas. I was not an attorney. I was not anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I was somebody he selected. Why he selected me? Well, only God knows, because I don't know the answer to that.
It's quite a powerful mystery.
But anything of any importance that was meant for the public and that the president wouldn't convey, I've done that now. And I just hope I haven't conveyed it too early. Or maybe sometimes I wonder, should I have done this a lot sooner?
Robert, maybe your timing is just right.
Maybe those things will surface, and maybe they'll surface for a good purpose, and to
right.
Eventually one day to clear up the president's name, and that the stigma of disgrace will be removed from his name.
Well, you certainly are setting the record straight now. It's an incredible story. And I just have a few questions left for you for today.
Sure.
I want to focus on a couple of things that I've made some notes on. Now, when he described the information they were getting from this ET being, you said, is that like Star Trek? And do we have things like Star Trek now or something along that line? How did he respond?
Yes, he said that was antiquated.
It was antiquated?
He said Star Trek was antiquated.
Wow.
He laughed at it. He said, we are so, so far advanced. He said, Robert, he said it would really take your breath away. He said, if you could only be exposed to some of the knowledge that we have and possess and could understand it. And he said, it took me a while. He said, but when I talked to different people, I guess he was referring to scientists, and found out, you know, about these things and what they could be used for and what could happen, I guess to him it was mind-boggling too, but he understood it far much more than I. I certainly didn't have the intelligence of his brain, that's for sure.
Well, it must have been a wild subject to be discussing with him.
To be honest with you, I could not intelligently discuss it with him. I'd have to be a rocket ship scientist or something to be able to talk to him. He's just beyond my ability.
Now, the part of the secret message that contained this ET formula, he had that in red. Now, I find that intriguing.
Yes, yeah, that was done in red ink with pens. It was all written. The letter was not typewritten. That was all handwritten.
Okay, and how many pages do you think the letter had?
I'd say maybe three, possibly four, but it was at least three pages.
Okay, and did he refer to a specific scientist at any time during this meeting?
Yes, he mentioned about a man that that he considered to be someone that he really admired and respected, the name of Sam Cohen. And I had no idea who Sam Cohen was, I think.
He's the famous bomb scientist.
A scientist of the neutron bomb.
Oh, right,
and,
yes.
I did not know anything about it. And Nixon did not go into that either. He did not say that. He just mentioned the name. He didn't say scientist, and he said he had a lot of respect for him. And that's when he got into the extraterrestrial stuff. He did not use that word either. He said that we had discovered things. He says, actually, what he did say, he said, we discovered things that came from the outer space. Mm-hmm. He said, maybe he's even a different universe. But you know what? He said, it came to our planet. The knowledge that we have from one of those things, he says, is so vast. And the discovery of that knowledge, he said, could be for the betterment of mankind, he said, in the entire universe, if it's used right. He said, but it was just like, who was it that invented the splitting of the atom?
Is it Oppenheimer?
Sounds like it. Mm-hmm. But he was saying that we used that knowledge, he said, to destroy mankind with, talking, I guess, about the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that that knowledge was meant to help mankind, not to destroy.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and this is the same type of knowledge that we have now. He says, from this new discovery, he says, it fell into our laps, is the exact word he said.
It fell into our laps. Wow. And he said where this being came from.
And that's when he started talking. He mentioned about a planet. Actually, I don't remember what he said about a planet, but I do remember he did mention specifically, because I had to look it up to see exactly what he was talking about.
Well, it's interesting because Planet X is something we hear about all the time now because they have so many new discoveries. And in fact, since the 19th century, that's been a kind of catch-all term for a planet that's theoretically right on the edge of our system. And of course, Sitchin's work in the 1970s stressed that Planet X was Nibiru from Sumerian astronomy. So that's all very interesting. But I'm getting the impression that Nixon was almost exuberant and was really communicating that to you.
Oh, he did. He did. He kept talking about the discoveries and the knowledge that we have. Kept using the word astronomical.
Hmm.
And he said, and unexplained, he said, we're learning every day. And he said, we can only understand the messages they left behind. He said, their writings, and we can only decipher those things. And there's encrypted, he called it encrypted messages, and then he even pulled some book that he had on the shelf, and it had some of the Egyptian things where they were some type of figures of what looked like men, but they like had with two heads, but then like a third eye,
mm-hmm.
you know, one of the heads. I mean, it.
Wow, it's amazing. You know, he's actually musing to you there about the extraterrestrial presence with Earth, even in ancient times.
Yes, but he. According to him, though, we had something like that in our possession already.
Right.
A living being.
A living being. And did he tell you how long we'd had it?
Yes, he said that it went back to the whatever the development was that started the stories about Area 51.
Well, it really makes sense because we have these people who came forward from covert programs that told us he, in fact, handled the real Project Blue Book cases with the CIA in the 1950s when he was vice president under Eisenhower. So basically, they'd had this ET being for about 20 years.
Yes.
And it begs the question, is it still alive and under our protection today?
Yes.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you responded to some of this information almost skeptically at first. How did that go?
Well, I mean, I was being, you know, the doubting Thomas and was being cynical with him about some of the stuff. And he said, well, he said, listen, he said, you come from West Virginia. He said, and your science is limited to a certain degree. He said, you don't have, what are these places you go to? They have a huge microscope inside you. I mean, a telescope inside you can see the stars and the universe.
Uh-huh. He said, observatories.
Yeah, I think he said something about West Virginia had one or they did not have one, or they were very scarce to the region that I came from. And he said, but if you studied this, he said, you would find out that there's a lot more to it than what you could possibly imagine. He said, and then again, he said, you would have to use your, he said, imagination, he says, to understand a lot of things, and you still wouldn't do it. Many of our scientists are totally baffled by it.
He discussed with you this all-important knowledge that they had discovered by communicating with this ET being, and he told you we actually possess that knowledge. Now, how did he describe it?
He said that it would be one of the greatest discoveries ever to be used for the good of mankind. He said, in the complete universe, and also, he said, or it could be used as the most dangerous thing possible. So when he said that, the only thing I could think of was the splitting of the atom.
Right.
That was the limit of my life. So I didn't pursue it anymore because I didn't want him to know just how dumb I was. So.
No, you certainly weren't dumb.
Yeah.
Quite the contrary. But he said to you that whoever possesses this information would be all-powerful in the world.
Yes. Well, he said we had it.
Uh-huh.
He didn't say how much or what, but he just said, yes, our country is the one who has it.
So presumably it makes us all-powerful.
He said all-powerful or all-devastating. He said it could be the best of mankind or could be the most nefarious thing that ever existed.
How did you feel after he read you this letter?
Honored. Honored that he would read such a important letter that contains not just national security, but I felt international security.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it would be the most devastating thing to the entire world. And he said most important, most valuable, most devastating, most important. He said, depending on who had it and how they could use it. That was his exact words.
Wow, amazing. It sounds like he was in awe of all the possibilities. Now, he told you he had hidden this message in the White House to be eventually discovered, and he told you where. Why do you think he wanted Kissinger to have this important letter?
Kissinger was the only person in the world he trusted, you know, and he certainly trusted Kissinger way, way further than he did me. I was just a courier to the president. That's all I was.
Interesting. You mentioned when he sent you off with this letter for Henry Kissinger, he taped it to your stomach. Did he give you a bodyguard or anything like that?
Oh, no. I was taken home for the last time in the car and let out right at my home. My apartment was the only apartment door that was an alleyway. So you walk around the corner of the building into the alley, and my door was right there.
It sounds like a pretty nerve-wracking assignment.
But he was very, he said that to show me just how careful and how cautious he was of everything. And he was trying to remind me about being extremely cautious about everything I did as well. And to notice who was always around me when I was by myself.
Did you deliver the letter to Kissinger?
I tried to, but his mate said he wasn't there. And she wanted me to try to leave. I said, no. I said, I'll get it to him. I didn't feel comfortable. I thought, you know, what if this woman is not a maid and she's a CIA agent or something?
Right.
So I simply did what the president told me to do, and I dropped it in the mailbox.
Okay.
And he did get it. He did get it. It was confirmed.
Oh, it was confirmed?
Yes, by Nancy Kissinger.
Okay.
Our Nancy, I don't know if her last name was Kissinger. I don't know if they were married at the time. I guess they were, but anyway, she's a woman did call me and said her name was Nancy, and when I found out later on that he did marry someone named Nancy, that it had to be the same person. But she did acknowledge that he did receive it.
So she wanted to let you know.
Yes. Because he had a private letter in the envelope that he did not read to me that was addressed personally between him and Henry Kissinger.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what was in it, and I didn't dare ask him what was in it, but I assumed that whatever was in that letter, unless Dan Kissinger had already talked about it, that Kissinger knew exactly what to do with everything.
It's an extraordinary relationship of trust from someone so powerful, but he certainly trusted you implicitly. But just looking at all this from your side now, many years later, how much of a burden has it been carrying all this information around and keeping it to yourself?
Horribly, horribly so. It was horrific, believe me. So much I wanted to talk about this so much to people, but Who would I talk to? Who would I talk to? I mean, and I'm elaborating on some of these little points is because I'm profiling you as I've been trying to do this with some. I'm a very good profiler. They didn't teach me. I know my own, but I can pick up in your voice, Daniel. I don't know who you are, and you're a very famous person. God bless you. But you know what? You seem to be a very honest, forthright person with a lot of integrity. All I want is my story to be told in a way that where the truth comes out.
Well, I really appreciate that, and I certainly will get your story out. Now, I know we've covered many extraordinary revelations here today, but what I want to close with is this. What do you want people to know about your three meetings with President Nixon at the White House and the kind of connection that you had with him?
But he was the greatest person I had ever met in my life. I'm sorry, and they should be too, those who is always putting down they would only know the truth and really learn the truth. And they would understand. I mean, he was to this day the greatest president that we've ever had.
Robert, you've had an incredible journey from humble roots in West Virginia to deep covert work for the Houston Plan and meeting with President Nixon, who gave you extraordinary information about the ET being and this amazing discovery scientists have made, and sharing with us the secret of Nixon's time capsule at the White House. I want to thank you on behalf of everyone watching for your courage and your candor. Your appearance here today really will change history.
Yes, well, I hope so. And, you know, I keep wondering about our world today. I just hope that with the way the world is going today, I hope that you're going to have time to even air your story.
I can definitely appreciate that. The world seems to be in quite a spiral these days. But the more we break through that wall of secrecy, the better our future looks all the time. So thank you again.
And the more candid I am in speaking of these things and very openly, and no matter how detailed, how vulgar, how they're all true. All true.
Absolutely, Robert. And we really appreciate your courage in coming forward.
Okay, I wish you the best, and I appreciate it, and thank you, and God, thank you for putting this out for me. And
it's my pleasure, and everyone listening appreciates it.
All right, thank you, Daniel, and please stay in touch with me, okay?
I will, and I look forward to speaking with you soon.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining me for this historic Dark Journalist broadcast. Now, there's more to come on this powerful story. And let me just say that in many hours of conversation, I found Robert Merritt to have remarkably consistent recall of past events, regardless of the many different ways we came to discuss them. Robert Merritt's incredible revelations not only change history, they also give us a greater understanding of the alien mystery and the secrecy surrounding the UFO file. The great opportunity that Robert Merritt has given us to get a glimpse beyond the wall of secrecy continues. I have here a request to the National Archives. With the promise of directions to the time capsule Nixon placed in the White House, the conditions state that the National Archives is welcome to the document, with the caveat that it must first be read aloud and then distributed to the public. Assisting Robert Merritt in this matter is former Watergate lawyer Douglas Caddy, whose careful work bringing Merritt's Watergate revelations to the public against the odds is admirable, and we're all grateful for his efforts. I'll be keeping you updated at darkjournalist.com as this incredible story unfolds. So let's change history. Let's do it now. Let's open Nixon's ET time capsule. I'm Dark Journalist. Thank you for joining me, and I'll see you soon.